It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
In the early hours of November 1st, 2014, jealousy turned to rage, and Joseph Carr murdered his girlfriend, stole a car, and disappeared into the darkness. Join us for the manhunt. Austin, Texas, with the U.S. Marshals Lone Star Fugitive Task Force, and today we're on the hunt for Joseph Frederick Carr. I'm Chris Gotzik. This is Chasing Evil. Joining me today is Mo Siddiqui and Troy Bodie, both who are retired from the Austin Police Department and were task force officers with the Lone Star Fugitive Task Force. Welcome. And we also have Detective Ben Wright from the Travis County Sheriff's Office. Ben gets a little extra love because Ben showed up like a little bit of an Austin law enforcement fashion plate with the tie and no coat today, but you look great.
Thank you.
And perfectly coiffed, and that's more than I can say for anybody else I've seen from the Lone Star Fugitive Task Force. So,
yeah, this is my sharp look.
You don't have another look.
Kind of made for TV kind of guy.
As we are on a podcast.
So let us jump right in to Joseph Frederick Carr. Mo, why don't you tell us how he came to your attention?
This was a murder case. It's how this case came across our desk. What the task force primarily does is identify, locate, and apprehend the most violent fugitives, mm-hmm. and primarily murder suspects.
Right.
And specifically, what we're very good at is locating murder suspects that are actively trying to evade law enforcement. Because we have the time, we have the resources, and the experience to do that. And so that's how this particular case came across our desk, because a woman by the name of Kelly Turner was brutally murdered in Austin, Texas, and the suspect was actively on the run, trying to avoid being captured right. by law enforcement.
How was she killed?
So basically, Kelly Turner... I was at the trial on this, so I remember this case. You know, we work a lot of cases on the task force. Yes. I mean, over hundreds of murders we've personally have arrested.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're like me and Troy, I'm going to throw you under the bus with me. We forget a lot of stuff. We just have a brain dump. I'd like to think it's because there's so much information coming in, but it's probably just because I've been punched in the head too many times and you're just getting older.
Oh, ouch.
But there's some guys that can really remember every little right. detail. I'm not one of those guys, but I remember this one in particular because I actually was on the trial for this.
Mm-hmm.
How this all came about is Kelly Turner is actually a hometown girl here in Austin. You know, she graduated from Westlake High School. I believe she attended the University of Texas at Austin. And upon graduating, you know, she's an adult and she wants to start her adult life. So she, like a lot of young adults do, they move away and try to set roots out and explore the world. And she ended up in California, I believe. And I believe she got a job as a flight attendant. And I can't remember. I think it was Southwest.
I believe
right.
so.
Right? Southwest. So by all accounts, you know, she's the nicest person you'd ever meet. She's the flight attendant you would want.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she's the person that's going to take care of you, going to come and fluff that pillow and ask how you're doing and making sure that you're comfortable and taken care of. Just a right. beautiful person. She meets this guy, Joseph Carr, and she meets him out in California, is my understanding. And he owns this business called Bohemian Blacksmith. He basically makes knives. So my understanding is that she got into a relationship with this guy, but she hadn't been home in quite a while. So she wanted to not only come back home to Austin to visit family and friends,
mm-hmm.
But she also wanted to take this as an opportunity to introduce Joseph Carr to her family and friends, because it appeared things were getting serious between them, between the two.
Right.
So what's really creepy about this case is this was like a Halloween case, right? Like, because I think the murder happened October 31st, which was a Friday.
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
So
2014,
correct. Yeah. Which is crazy, because that's like I was telling you the other day, it's like 10 years have flown by, but for it feels like yesterday. When we start thinking about the case. Mm-hmm. Anyways, they come into Austin, Kelly and Joseph, and they stay with a friend in Southwest Austin that Kelly had. And I think on Wednesday, so 2 days before the murder,
right,
that's actually when Kelly takes Joseph to meet with her family, not her friends, but family. They have dinner. And what's significant about that is that that dinner is going to be the last time that her family, her actual blood, ever sees her again. So they do that on Wednesday. Then Friday, you know, they're adults, and they get, my understanding, they get dressed up and they're going out, not doing the kid, the 18-year-old UT Halloween deal, but you know, the more adult, maybe like the Rainy Street version, right, where they go to a couple of bars or whatever. But I think what happens is they go out. If I remember correctly, what some of the people that were out there with them, the friends that testified, basically was like, you know, Joseph was being an ass the entire time, was basically like jealous that how come you're spending all this time with your friends, not paying attention to me, and it was just, she was not having a good time, right? Kelly was not having a good time, and he was making it a point, Joseph, just being a little baby. So around midnight, they wrap it up. They go home to the friend's house in Southwest Austin. The friend of Kelly, her boyfriend or husband,
correct,
his name was Mike Hammond, right? And so they go to bed, and I guess they believe, like, okay, well, Joseph and Kelly, they're going to go to bed now, right? And it was maybe like an hour later where, according to, and I wish I remembered this woman's name, but Mike Hammond's girlfriend, or wife, I'm not even sure if they were married or whatever, but anyways, she reports that, like, she heard a scream that she had never, ever heard before. Like, it was like nothing she ever heard before. So, I believe Mike, we're in Texas, so he has a gun. And he grabs his gun. He's going to go investigate, like, what's going on, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So their bedroom is upstairs. He gets to the stairs. And if I remember correctly from reports, he sees Joseph at the bottom of the staircase, covered in blood, holding a knife, and is basically, like, mumbling to himself, like, oh, my God, I can't believe I killed her. And at some point, Joseph looks up at Mike and starts to make, like, he's going to start making his way up the stairs. And Mike is like, hold up now, and points the gun at him.
Right.
And at which point Joe has enough sense, right? He's to be like, I don't want to get shot, being the coward that he is. He starts to rummage around the house. Well, come to find out, he's actually looking for car keys. And he finds the car keys for, I believe it's Mike's car. It was a yellow FJ Cruiser. I'll never forget that. Yeah. And that's it. He bails. He takes the FJ Cruiser, steals it, right? And he's gone. And at that point, that's pretty much when the task force gets called in.
Right. Not to be morbid about it or exploitive, but how many times did he stab her?
Over 30 times is what I remember.
Right.
I can't remember what the official reports were, but it was over 30 times. I know that.
And in your all experience, what does that tell you about a crime? Does that indicate anything to you
That's
in particular?
Rage.
Personal rage.
Yes.
100%. Which is significant in this particular case. Because at the trial, Joseph tries to claim self-defense. Right? Now, I'm not a homicide detective, but we are privileged to have one with us today. And I can tell you from my experience that I have never worked a case where the victim stabbed somebody 37 times or 38 times or however, you know, over 30 times, right?
Right.
Which is basically what he claimed, that he was the victim.
Right.
But yet she had over 30 wounds from a knife.
Yeah, we don't see that very often.
this is all going to be debatable, right? But you're right. Like rage, jealousy, all those types of things. He's just, you know, it's a person that loses control.
Right. But they say about somebody who can actually stab somebody more than once, that's so up close and personal.
It's very personal. It's very different from shooting someone, right? It's a knife going into somebody's flesh, and you got to push it in, and you got to do that multiple times. And that's exactly what he did.
I've interviewed several people who have stabbed someone, and that is a very common response, is that that first stabbing is a real wake-up call. Whatever moment they were having, no matter how mad they were, it's almost like disbelief. And in several of the attacks, you know, they stab them that first time, and then they realize, oh, well, I'm in it now. So they continue to stab them. But, yeah, it's a moment when you actually get up close and personal and stab someone.
Do we know, did he have any history of any mental illness or any rage disorder, anger management issues?
Me personally, I never came across anything throughout whether a homicide was doing their investigation, right, through our own fugitive investigation, or even during the trial, if he had any mental illness or anything like that. I do remember that the sister of Kelly saying that, you know, at dinner there was no signs. There was no signs. Like on that Wednesday they had dinner as a family, she testifies like he was quiet, but you know, he's introverted. And mm-hmm, so, mm-hmm. But she didn't pick up on any signs like this guy's going to murder my sister.
Right. Right. Interesting. So he leaves and the call obviously goes to 911. And how long does it take that case to get adopted by the Lone Star Fugitive Task Force?
I think probably within 3 to 4 hours, they were called in to assist homicide, start doing the background research.
So these are additional Austin police officers who are detailed to the task force, but also work with the homicide detectives if you think that the Marshall's task force is going to adopt a case.
That's correct.
They'll know everything about it even beforehand.
Correct.
So it saves time. Got it.
Yes.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Chris, and I can't remember who the secondary officer was, so they, mm-hmm, they do all the research. Joseph Carr left a cell phone at the residence. Obviously, he left in a hurry.
Oh, that's right, because that's one of the avenues that we're looking at locating him, right?
I don't even know if he had his wallet on him to have any source of revenue, mm-hmm, to escape very far. And the vehicle, I believe, we knew that it had like a quarter tank of gas or something. So we knew that there's a potential that he wasn't going to get too far.
Calling all lovers of mystery. Prepare to don your detective hat in June's Journey, a free hidden object mobile game that delves into the captivating journey of June Parker, a self-proclaimed detective on a quest to unravel the mystery surrounding her sister's untimely death. Take a trip in time to the glitzy 20s and play as June, deciphering clues and unveiling secret plots within thousands of beautifully illustrated scenes. The thrill is endless, with new chapters added weekly, allowing you to not only enjoy the detective adventure, but also to personalize and decorate your very own Orchid Island, where the story takes place. How sharp are your detective skills? Find out when you download June's Journey on your Android or iOS device, or play online via Facebook Games. Your detective journey awaits.
So as far as technology, we didn't have a whole lot of resources, and he had no ties or connections to the Austin area other than his girlfriend. So we basically had a bolo put out for the vehicle.
Be on the lookout for.
That's correct.
Okay.
And we were all called in maybe late at 6 in the morning, 7. Mm-hmm.
Right? You spend the day, yeah, canvassing, like, you know, doing some basic stuff like just canvassing hotels, looking for this FJ Cruiser. Because we had a plate. And it's funny, right? Like, that's one of the things you'll hear cops say this all the time, is that you'll never see a yellow FJ Cruiser, right? But the moment somebody puts out a bolo for one, it's like everywhere. So right. Everybody's seeing these FJ Cruisers, and you're getting behind them, and you're checking the plate, and you're like, oh, man, it's not our guy. It's not our guy. And that's basically what we do all day until Sarge tells us to break it down. And break it down just means what we say when we're like, we're done for the day. We're going to go home and rest for a little bit.
Right.
We work all day Saturday.
Correct.
Break it down. No luck on anything. And Sarge usually said something to the effect of like, rest until you feel good enough to come back out. But on this one, it was like, we don't have anything. If something happens, we'll call you. Right. And sure enough, we end up getting a call that same day. Right.
Oh yeah.
Correct. Same day.
I know these guys feel the same way, but Troy and I were talking, you're not in the club yet, Ben, but you will be soon. You will
retirement
be soon.
Club.
We were talking about like, you know,
just a real question. Yeah. Will Ben dress this way when he's retired?
He can dress in jeans and a t-shirt and he will still look magnificent.
Okay.
Yeah. So this is an ongoing different. Thing with Ben. Like he gets this reaction. He's very used to it. Everywhere he goes, he's always gotten this reaction. His hair is well kept. He's a very handsome man.
And just because I've been to some offices where, especially the marshals, where there'll be one suit in the office, and there's one story where they each had to take a photograph, and they all use that one suit. Whether and some fit, some didn't fit, and then they sent them. I think it was to headquarters, and headquarters go, okay, you know what? Stop being ridiculous. We want you to wear a suit that actually fits. So this is still, you know, it's unusual and it's respected.
Well, you know, for 17 years when I was a task force officer full time, before I started doing the homicide stuff, I dressed like they did, you know, blue jeans, t-shirts, you know, it wasn't always.
You're being met with certain really? Level of skepticism.
I fixed my hair every day. Yes. I will say
we're all jealous of Ben. Let's just say.
There's, okay.
All
right. Well, let's.
Thanks for the love.
Let's get back to this because you guys are now resting. You've been searching all day. You know, since the murder has happened, you have essentially no leads except that you know that he's associated with a yellow FJ Cruiser, and you've been searching all over the city of Austin and its outer parts for this one particular yellow FJ Cruiser. And I would think, you know, like you guys did, is like, how many could there be? And of course, when you're looking, more than you could possibly have thought.
Yeah.
So you get a call on a Sunday.
Yeah, that's right. No. It was Saturday. Same day.
Okay, so yeah, you get a call on Saturday.
We start work. Yeah, we get a call on Saturday. We start working it. We come up with nothing looking for this FJ Cruiser. Like Troy was saying, you know, we have some other resources that we can use to sometimes locate people that don't want to be found. But we didn't have that in this particular case, right? Mm-hmm. The guy doesn't have any wallet, doesn't have any money. I wanted to get this guy. Everybody wanted to get this guy. So we get that call,
well,
right?
I'll interrupt you because I will tell you that I was cheating this day. So, you know, we have to balance work life, family life.
Yeah, sure.
And on this particular Saturday morning, I'm listening to the radio because I know we've got the email. We've been told that we're on standby for this to look for him. Predominantly APDs out running around, some of the Marshall guys. But we haven't really got any good solid leads. So I'm just monitoring. My kid had a soccer game that morning. So I'm going to the soccer game, just hoping that they don't find him until midway through the game so I can get out of there. You know, I don't miss anything. The excitement of the takedown or the excitement of the soccer game. And so the game had just ended. Timing was perfect. I'm like, okay, I'm going to grab a little bite. Then I'm going to go join the guys in this hunt. And we get the call that that someone has spotted the our suspect's FJ Cruiser.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can't remember. I think it was Joe Candoli, who at the time was our detective, that actually called in and was like, hey, Mo, they found this.
Was it within the city limits of Austin?
Hayes County, yeah.
Which is where, for those of us not from?
Southwest
of Austin.
Of Austin. Probably 10 miles. Within 5 miles of the actual crime scene, correct? Now, maybe a little eight.
It was not too far because from South Austin where the crime occurred. He didn't make it very far.
No. Uh-huh.
Okay.
So I can't remember. Troy, did we double up that day?
Yeah.
Or did I meet you out there?
Mo's a very slow driver. And so I was his driver most of the time.
I'm also very grumpy when I don't get to eat or I don't get to sleep. I don't want to drive.
You're
anywhere.
Not alone.
We live very close to each other. Mm-hmm. So I think call Troy and it's like, hey, let's double up. Let's jump in the same vehicle. And we'll start heading towards where they found the FJ Cruiser. Now, the FJ Cruiser, I can't remember. I think I was asking you, Troy. Was it a resident in Hayes County that spotted this and then called it in?
From my understanding, they got a 911 call.
Right.
Okay. They got in on a 911 call. Yeah. Okay. So what we were told is they found this FJ Cruiser. It was abandoned in a field in Hayes County.
Yes, I think it's Driftwood was the closest area, and there was a blood scene outside the driver's door.
What is that? Inside and outside. The car was...
Define blood scene.
There was a tremendous amount of blood inside of the vehicle, as well as some evidence of bandages.
Led you to believe that it was more of his blood versus the victim's blood. There's that much around the vehicle.
Oh, okay. So that's got to be surprising then.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. So we head towards that location, and of course, that's one of the beautiful things about the task force is the persistence and the dedication. We get there, and it's like there's every task force members out there, and because the FJ Cruiser is empty, we know this guy is on foot. He's potentially, you know, we're not too far behind him. He can't get too far on foot.
Describe what kind of area. I mean, are you in an urban area? Is it
rural? Yeah, the setting. It's not residential. You're looking at car more like farm style homes on 2 to 12 acre lots.
Oh, okay. So there's some room to roam.
Correct.
Oh, it's country. Okay. It's country out there. Yeah. So the hunt's on, right? Like, we know this guy's close by on foot, doesn't have resources. It's not like somebody's going to come and pick him up.
Right.
Right. So he has to be somewhere around here. When Troy and I get there, I think Ben gets there almost around the same time, probably. And we link up with our sergeant, and everybody's kind of, you know, is doing a job already. And so there's this idea on the task force is find work, right? If you get there and somebody, you know, you don't just stand around, find work, find something to do. So Troy and I are like, you know what? What would we, you know, I think that's the way a good cop should think is what would you do if you were the bad guy, right? And so it's like, well, there are residences around here. If I was the bad guy, I might hide out at one of the residences. I might break into somebody's barn. You know, so we're like, hey, let's start knocking on people's doors and just letting them know why law enforcement is around. If you see something suspicious, lock your doors, call 911. You're out in the country. So a lot of these country folk here in Texas, they have guns. They don't close their doors. And they have signs that say, enter at your own risk.
Right.
And we understand that, right? But we also want to keep our people safe. So we're out there knocking on doors. And I can tell you, I was telling Troy, I didn't really think about it at the time, but that was the most scary. You know, we all know how the story ends, right? We're going to find the guy and we're going to end up getting him. But that was the most scared
Actually,
I was.
No one knew that.
So. Oh, no one knew that. Okay.
Thanks for that. Spoiler alert. I'm glad I wasn't with you when Game of Thrones was on. Thank you.
I'm sorry about that. We can edit this though. That was the most scared I was. And because there's a lot.
Now, when you say that, is that something that actually happens to you often on some of these things that there's a component?
On these situations, yeah, 100%. You're talking about like when we're going out and knocking on people's doors and checking people's residences. Yeah, that's something that's quite common. And on those situations, those are the ones. I can't speak for everybody else. I never really get scared when the suspect is right in front of me.
Right.
Because we've rehearsed it so many times, we've done it so many times, and I feel like we're not behind the eight ball.
Right.
But no matter what you do, you can never train for an ambush. Can't. And every time you're looking under somebody's bed or pulling over a couch, I mean, the only thing that's going through your head is like, this guy's going to jump out with a knife and get me next, right? And there's no way I can train for that. I'm like, I'm too far behind the eight ball. So I didn't like that. But Troy and I, we kind of knocked on every, you know, the immediate area. We knocked on a bunch of doors, talked to a bunch of people, which was good because people were nervous. They saw like Air One and there's a ton of cops out there.
Right.
Yeah. So when we get doing that, no luck, we head back to kind of the general area where everybody's searching. And that's when we link up with Ben.
There's actually a canine and they're tracking it at this whole time while we're out canvassing.
And what is the canine tracking?
Scent.
The blood?
Yeah, he started at the vehicle.
Okay.
And so...
So there are canines that are not necessarily just tracking the scent of clothing, but blood as well? Or is it a clothing thing?
No, I think it's the human scent. So whatever they picked up, like I said, there was a lot of bandages, makeshift as well as regular bandages that were outside the vehicle, inside the vehicle.
Okay.
So it allowed for them to have something really significant that they knew belonged to him to get on. And this is a pretty wooded area. There were, you know, without getting too geographical, there was a lot of wooded area directly where the vehicle was parked. And then the houses were just a little further down the street, kind of spread out, you know, on 1 and 2 acre mm-hmm. plots. And so I feel as though these type of cases, you know, make you a little nervous because you definitely have someone at that point where realize, okay, he's injured. And potentially he's injuring himself, which means he might be suicidal. And so now you have this guy out there. For whatever reason, he didn't finish the job on himself. So he's now out there. And is he going to want us to do the job? Is he going to, you know, jump out and ambush us or what have you? Is he going to hurt other people? If you're willing to hurt yourself, you're willing to do what he's done to this beautiful young lady, you know, sky's the limit on what he'll do to us.
Right.
So I think it does heighten everybody's emotions, you know, makes you a little aware. We work in teams. We work well together. And so after, I mean, we had quite a few groups that were going door to door and et cetera. And then about the time that broke down, we kind of shifted kind of maybe towards the outer perimeter, down the main road that led to that area. And that's where I was in my vehicle. And then I doored up with the guys, with Mo and Troy. And then we're just talking about, you know, why I was late to the game, all those kind of things.
We call it 25 and right. It's like when his driver's side door meets up with his driver's side door and you roll down your windows and you're just kind of like, just talking about what's going on.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
So Ben actually, he observed someone down the road and was like, you know, it's probably not the guy, but we're, you know, we got to do work. We got to find work.
Right. But how many would you say members of law enforcement are there at this point?
There's a lot.
There's a lot.
I mean, if you look at the Air One footage, right? I
25, 30.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah. There's quite a few. And so at a certain point, you can kind of muddy the water when they're already on this, you know, mission. They got work to do and you're trying to get in. So you just kind of want to leave them alone, let them do what they're already doing, and you find somewhere else to be useful. Mm-hmm. So Ben was kind of like, hey, there's this guy down the road. Maybe it's not our guy, but maybe he saw something, right. You know. So Troy is kind of like, all right, well, lead the way. So Ben begins to pull off, and Troy does this U-turn. To get behind Ben. And to the left is this huge open field, and what separates the road from that field is like this wire country fence, mm-hmm. right?
Call mm-hmm. that barbed wire in Texas. There,
barbed wire. Barbed wire fence. I can't tell if I was tired or whatnot, but when he made that U-turn, as I'm looking out the window,
yeah,
I just see kind of what looks like, it's not quite grass. To me, it was like, man, that could have been the top of somebody's head. And a part of me was like, nah, you're kind of seeing things. But then my gut was like, well, we got to find work. And, you know, we might as well.
This is work.
This is work. Right. This is work. So I was like, Troy, stop the car. And I think Troy kind of like looking in the same direction I'm looking at this point and sees me.
Maybe it was like a tree stump at first.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's one thing. Like, it's just the family thing. Like, if I see Troy do something, I'm not even going to ask him, like, why are you doing it? I'm just going to follow him, right? And same thing. So Troy sees me, like, I'm like, stop the car. He stops the car, and I immediately jump out the car. Right. When I'm jumping out of the car, Troy's not going to ask me, like, Troy knows why I'm jumping out of the car,
right?
So he jumps out, and he's
I mean, and we're talking about, it's not something you were looking at for a long period of time. I mean, we're talking about just a
split second.
Oh, yeah, well, they're making the U-turn to make this turn. And literally, as we're pulling away from each other, I hear Mo say, hey, what's that? And then their window's kind of drifting away from me at that time. So I end up pulling back around, and I'm grabbing my binoculars because I'm not sure what we're looking at yet, but I feel like we've seen something. Everybody's starting to get out of their vehicle. So I grab my binoculars, and I start looking, and sure enough, just sitting out in this middle of this field is Joseph Carr. He looks pretty wild-eyed. And
you saw him through the binoculars.
Through the binoculars. I'll remember like it was yesterday because he looked really crazy. He had attempted to harm himself is what it looked like. And he had these huge pieces of meat hanging out of his neck on both sides where he had attempted to sever his own throat. And so he just had these kind of like these wounds, and it was covered in blood. And it just looked like something. It almost didn't even look real. It was so crazy in the binoculars. And so I confirmed, yeah, hey, that is somebody out there. And the guys were already getting out of their vehicle.
And where was the bloodhound at this point? I mean, was the scent taken?
Too far.
The crowd of law enforcement in another direction that this guy was alone in a field?
They had not tracked him that far yet. I think they were behind and would eventually caught up to him.
Right. Yeah.
They were just methodically going through what other steps, and they were up on a hillside. Okay. So it probably would be difficult to...
It's about a quarter of a mile from where we were.
Yes.
Easy.
Yeah, easy. Uh-huh. Easy.
And it's just the three of us out there in the middle of this giant field. It's a big open area.
And I want to clarify, I'm the oldest out of these guys, and I think I won getting over the fence. Didn't I?
You did.
I did.
You did.
I won that day.
You know what? I can't say it's a big victory, but take the W. At our age, you know, every
it's
W
something
is
to brag
important.
About. Yeah,
sure.
Exactly.
In all fairness, I'd grabbed my rifle for some long cover so that they could safely get over the fence.
That was smart.
So
yeah,
I was last to get over the fence. So I got on target with him, with Mr. Carr. And at that point, he's seeing us and seeing us making motion towards him. And so he is standing up and he is, he is brandishing a...
I'll tell you something about that. That is the one thing that really, really stands out to me is that he stayed ducked down. And actually, if you look at the Air One footage, all around it is like short grass. Mm-hmm. And then there's just like this patch of tall grass. So somehow he's skull dragged his way to this tall grass and laid down. And he was kind of aware, like, okay, those are some cops over there. He never actually stood up until Troy and I jumped the fence.
Mm-hmm.
The minute like our feet land on the other side of that fence, it was like right out of a movie. Seriously, this guy Troy says he stood up out of the water like Jesus, because he stood up with his arms spread eagle like this.
Right.
And he's not wearing a shirt.
Holding a butcher knife.
And he's holding the knife. And immediately I'm like, that's probably the knife that he used to murder Kelly. You know, and I'm like, okay, man, this is real now. Also at the same time, I'm like, we did our job. Like, we found the guy. Now when we still got to finish the job, but like, we found this dude.
And does he make any attempt to run?
We first engage him, and I think I first drew down him, and you came up to my flank on my left, right? Mm-hmm. And he stood up, as Mo described, and it was a pretty eerie feeling, because he had lacerations both sides of his neck. He had them underneath both arms, and he's wearing cargo shorts, and that was all he had on was cargo shorts. Right. And he had lacerations on the inner thighs on both sides. So you've got this guy stand up with a butcher knife, long hair, kind of just messy looking, and he just blood dripping all over his body.
Mm.
And then when you start giving him verbal commands, and he just kind of gives you the deer in the headlight look, and we knew he wasn't going to cooperate at that point. And that's when
Did he say anything? Did he respond?
You know, at that point, we're trying to get him to surrender peacefully.
Right.
Right. So we want him to drop the weapon, and then we have a tactic where we actually make them crawl to us. We don't go to them. Mm-hmm. We make them come to us. And part of that is like I said, we've done this lots of times, and we've had to talk and negotiate with murder suspects lots of times. So part of that is you got to baby these guys. It makes you sick, but you got to baby them a little bit, right? So like, oh, you're going to be okay.
Right.
You're the victim here. Right. We're here to help you.
Right.
And that's exactly what I told him. I'm like, hey, we're here to keep you safe. And that's the reality of it, because if patrol would have stopped this guy, most likely there would have been a shooting or a patrol officer would have got hurt, right? So us finding him is actually best case scenario for him and for law enforcement, in my opinion. But anyways,
that's correct.
I'm telling him, like, we're here to help you. And I remember him distinctly saying, you guys are not here to help me. You guys don't care about me, right? Like, it's about him. He's the victim.
Mm-hmm.
And that just goes on to the point where, like, somebody else kind of takes over, right? So, like, I'm telling him, drop the weapon. You know, we're here to help you. We want to hear your side of the story. Right. We know there's two versions of events. You know, all that type
and
of thing.
And how long does it take the group, the other 30 officers, to converge on your position?
As Mo's talking to him, I'm on the radio.
Right.
Trying to get everybody to our location. I would say probably less than 5 minutes. I mean, a couple of minutes.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It was. It seemed like a long time because, you know, at that point, Mr. Carr was making it very clear that he wanted us to end his life. He was telling Mo and us to just shoot him, and you know, but he wasn't approaching us. And Mo just starts talking to him about football. Like he's like, "Hey, no, I've got family, and you know, I want to watch a football game this afternoon, and no one's going to hurt you." And just really does a good job mm-hmm. of kind of just baffling him, because I don't think that's the response he was expecting. I think he was expecting us to come charging at him, screaming at him, and Mo really did not. Mo took it down very quiet, even though it was a long distance. There was no one out there. It was very easy to hear each other, and continued to just talk to him and tell him no matter what he thought or whatever was going on, that, you know, we were going to make this better for him and we're going to get him help, and that we wanted to hear his side of the story, and did a really good job of just kind of keeping him confused long enough to get additional resources. And it was a good 3 to 4 minutes, which doesn't seem like a long time until you're thinking, "Oh, I'm going to have to shoot this guy."
If he takes two steps
this direction,
right?
Yeah, a butcher knife that's already clearly knows how to use it. He was a very interesting character. So we started getting other people to join us. Canines arrived. We were able to get Less Lethal in the play. With some Less Lethal shotguns, which are the, you know, shotguns that shoot the bing bag rounds. Mm-hmm. And then we stacked up and started giving him more commands. You know, he never really approached. He just kind of held himself hostage, for lack of a better term. He would put the knife to his chest and threaten to stab himself if we advanced anymore. So we were just kind of in a stalemate. And, you know, we have always found that in those cases, you know, the more time that we can buy into this standoff, it bodes well for law enforcement and for, mm-hmm. you know, in this case, Mr. Carr.
Mm-hmm. So he's standing there. You're giving him commands. It seems like there's not much progress. There's a standoff, and it just seems like it's going to go on for a while. Yeah,
this guy was a coward, right? That, I mean, that's just what it came down to. At the end of the day, he did not want to face the consequences of his crimes, but yet he didn't have the guts. He could kill someone else, but he couldn't kill himself. So now he has to drag law enforcement into it, and it's like, "Oh, well, let me see if I can force them to kill me, because mm-hmm. I know that if I charge towards them, they'll probably shoot me." And I think all the time about that. I was like, "Man, you know, one of us could have been stabbed, killed."
It was certainly possible for him to force his hand if he ran towards you guys.
Yeah, and I think that's what he was doing. He was trying to play those scenarios in his head.
Right.
You know, like all the different scenarios. Can I get away? Can I get them to... Well, okay, what's it going to be like if they shoot me? Do I really want that to happen? I think he's just running... All the scenarios that he's running through his head are about how he can save himself.
Right.
You know what I mean? It's like, how can I benefit myself? Mm-hmm, up until the point of the trial, right? He ends up claiming self-defense. So it's all about, how can I save myself? I'm the victim here.
Right.
I'm looking at, you know, Mr. Carr through my sights, trying to make an assessment of, you know, at what point I'll have to stop him if he were to start to attack us or charge us. And, you know, Mo was doing just an amazing job of continuing to talk to him calmly about what I would consider to be random at the moment. I'm sure Mr. Carr felt they were random. You know, talking about family, talking about Saturday football, plans for the afternoon. And I think that interaction really kept Mr. Carr from being able to make that decision to force us to take his life. So, mm-hmm. You know, while it sounds like a little bit of flattery on Mo's part, he did a good job. And, you know, I'm a talker, and I always enjoy being the voice. I like to talk to our bad guys. I do like to do interviews, those kind of things. And this is one of those cases where I found myself in that lethal position where I'm holding lethal cover on this gentleman so that my teammates can do the rest of the work, which is notify the team where we are and get other resources, as well as, you know, keep the situation from escalating any further. Right. And, you know, as watching Mr. Carr right through this scope, you know, I see his facial expressions, and he'll start to huff and puff and make these, you know, animal noises, like he's trying to psych himself up to do something, either harm himself or charge us. And then Mo would be able to just kind of bring him back out of that with just a few words. And then he, you know, it went on like that until we were able to have more more folks there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think one of the things is like, you know, some people may listen. Hopefully, a lot of people listen to the podcast.
Here we go.
The whole world. This is like Joe Rogan. You better get out of town, buddy.
Stop it. But I hope you're right.
I don't know if they're ever going to be able to relate to, because it's just not a movie, right? Like, if what it's like for Ben to have to make these split second decisions on, am I going to have to pull this trigger and take a man's life? Because some people literally have said, and I remember this playing armchair quarterback. Why didn't they just shoot him? Mm-hmm. You know,
yeah.
People that never did the job before. Why didn't you just shoot him? You know, I would say that I think that's a testament to the professionalism of the particular unit,
mm-hmm.
because I can say that I was on the unit for 8 years and had over as a unit had hundreds of murder suspects arrested, and we never shot any of them. And not only that, but what a lot of people need to realize, and I hope they do realize, is that shooting him is what he wanted. That's the easy way out,
mm-hmm,
you
mm-hmm.
know, as opposed to, you know, doing his time and life in prison,
right.
which is where he's at now.
Right.
And it takes a lot. Shooting's, you know, that's easy. Getting a guy that doesn't want to cooperate to get him into handcuffs, that's a whole nother skill set.
Right. So time goes by, you're making that decision, and there's probably a feeling that we need to bring this to a conclusion.
Yeah, so by that time, we get a lot of resources. I mean, we have Air One up above us flying, mm-hmm. right? So like, this guy's not going to go anywhere now.
Right.
And then we set up what we call an L configuration. So one of the first things is we have about 30 officers there now, right? And Ben is 100% right. Like, if he had any thoughts of trying to get away, he probably should have done it before all those 30 officers got there, plus the there's like two canines or something.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, he's not going to outrun the dogs or, you know, Air One.
Right.
And they set up this L configuration. I think that at this point we're like, okay, if he does charge, we need to be lined up. Like, I don't want, Troy doesn't want me standing behind him shooting, right? Like, we need to be shoulder to shoulder, and we need to be watching to make sure there's no crossfire situations, all mm-hmm. that type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Once we do that, now we know we have the situation under control. And it's not a matter of if, it's just a matter of when. And eventually he gets to a point where he works up enough courage to basically plunge this knife into his own chest, right? Mm-hmm. I think he's ready to, like, I think he finally drew that conclusion in his head, like, okay, let me just do this. And I would say that's probably one of the most proudest moments of my career. That's what I would say. Not that he put the knife in his chest. It's what these guys did afterwards, right? A lot of people would have said, man, Kelly Turner, you read about her life. She's such a beautiful person. And when you take her life, you didn't just take her life. Like, that's probably the worst thing a parent can ever go through.
Yeah.
Losing a child.
Sure.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
That's like, I would say you're like the Walking Dead. That's how I would feel. I have a son.
Right.
You take my son from me, I'm existing. I'm not right. really living for right. the rest of my life.
Right.
So he's destroyed them. And a lot of people would say, well, man, why try to save this guy? Just let him bleed out.
Right.
You know, you don't have any moral obligation to. And that shows the professionalism of these guys, that they don't let their emotions get involved. Right.
Right.
They do their job.
Mm-hmm.
And so we do deploy some beanbags. Give them a little bit of love.
So he's standing there and Mo's talking to him still. And he's got the knife at his chest, and at some point you see him kind of thrust inward to his
mm-hmm.
chest,
mm-hmm.
And then he goes to the ground, I think, immediately at that point, correct?
Yeah, he makes a large, he growls and then just kind of starts shoving it in, kind of slow. He doesn't stab himself necessarily. He plunges. He just starts pulling the knife into his chest area, and as soon as we see that movement, you have several people, you know, yell impact, which there was kind of a plan in place that if he did something, we were going to start with less lethal means to try to thwart him. And so they did. They impacted him at least two times, maybe three. And as he's going to the ground.
With beanbags.
With beanbags.
Right.
Yeah, with these beanbag rounds. And then the knife comes out of his hand.
But it's still in close proximity.
Oh,
so he's still a threat
close.
At that point.
Right.
Way too close. But he does. That's when he goes to the ground, is when he gets beanbagged. That does stop his mobility, which is what they're designed to do.
Right.
So, And then we were able to get closer to him. I remember securing the knife after Sergeant Sikowski kicked it away from him. Actually, the end of the knife was broke off, which led me to believe that he actually broke the knife on his sternum when he tried to thrust it into his chest.
Uh-huh. Yeah, he had lots of injuries at that point. But one of the things that we run with as a task force is we always have guys that have medic training. Not always, but we try to have medic training guys there. And in this particular case, we had several people. We had EMS standing by. So we were able to get him treated really quickly. As a matter of fact, I remember as handcuffs were trying to go on him, we were looking at tourniquets, and they were already applying, you know, direct pressure to the wound in his chest. And I mean, it almost seemed a little surreal. He was gone very quickly. Like from the moment the impact of the beanbags to he's secured, they're loading him up, and he's on his way to a hospital. And then it's just kind of over. And then you know, so for me, I went from family soccer game to almost taking this gentleman's life and being put in that position to, all right, we're done. High five. Good job. And then back to the family to go have dinner that night. So it's an interesting job working for the task force, because that's the way it is every day.
Right.
You know, so.
That's well put. That's exactly. It's just up and down. It's crazy.
So when you were at the trial, his plea is not guilty and he's claiming self-defense. Did he say anything? I don't know if he testified, or did his lawyer put it in any way, shape, or form that it sounded remotely credible that there was a potential for self-defense?
Well, I mean, I would imagine his attorney thought, you know, this was the best defense to get. That's what they went with.
I was just curious in terms of
you didn't see him testify. What I do know.
Did he did testify?
He did testify, which is really crazy, because you usually don't have the suspect get on stand.
Right.
Right. But he did. And probably was the nail in the coffin for him. I mean, I think the trial itself, and correct me if I'm wrong, Ben, it was only a 3-day trial.
It was very quick.
Very quick.
It did not take jurors very long to see exactly what this was and what it, you know, and give him what he did.
Yeah. Right. And his sentence was what?
Life. Life in prison.
Life in prison.
Mm-hmm.
And as a state charge, because we know if it's federal, you do the time. What does that mean in as a state charge?
Yeah, I'm not clear what the actual sentence, if it was life with parole or life without parole, but it doesn't mean till the end of his natural life. It is a finite sum. So in this particular case, I bet he'll be eligible in like 20 years for parole.
Right.
Now, he won't get it on his first. That doesn't seem to be the case. But, you know, he'll walk the streets again at some point in his natural life, unless something happens to him while in prison.
Right.
There was one thing on the trial. What I distinctly remember is that Kelly Turner's, I believe this was her father. This was one of the things that stood out, like the 8 years sobbing during the trial.
Mm-hmm.
And I distinctly remember he came up to me, Sergeant Sikowski at the time, who was a sergeant over Tech Intel, and he shook our hands and said, thank you for catching this guy, you know. To give him some sort of peace, right? Like, this guy's just not out on the loose, and it's terrible, terrible.
Right. That must be very satisfying to know that you've been able to bring some sense of relief to Kelly Turner's family. Mo Siddiqui, Troy Bodie, Ben Wright, thank you very much for coming in and sharing your story and helping bring justice to Kelly Turner. As always, please help us spread the word about Chasing Evil. Tell your friends, leave us a glowing review, and of course, give us a 5-star rating. We would truly appreciate it. And finally, Chasing Evil is produced with the cooperation of the United States Marshals Service and contains interviews with current and retired employees, as well as other persons. Opinions, positions, and views expressed by any of them may not reflect the official views, positions, or policies of the United States Marshals Service. Be safe, everyone.
Prescription products require completion of an online medication consultation with an independent healthcare provider through the LifeMD platform and are only available if prescribed. Subscription required. Individual results may vary. Additional restrictions apply at LifeMD.com. Read all warnings before using GLP-1s. Side effects may include a risk of thyroid C-cell tumors. Do not use GLP-1s if you or your family have a history of thyroid cancer.
If you've struggled for years to lose weight and have given up hope, did you know you can now access GLP-1 prescription medications through LifeMD? LifeMD is now offering eligible patients online access to GLP-1s, the breakthrough prescription medication that can help you lose body fat and weight. Listen to what people are saying.
Probably the easiest thing I've ever done. The medication comes in the mail and it's very easy to use. I've been able to live my normal lifestyle and I've lost 20 pounds already and I've never felt better. It changed my life.
And here's the best part. Your insurance may cover 100% of the cost of your medication. So go to TryLifeMD.com to have your eligibility checked right now. Get started today at TryLifeMD.com. That's TryLifeMD.com.